There is a sixth dimension beyond that which is known to reasonable man. It is a dimension as vast as Gallagher's talent and as timeless as when Justin met Kelly. It is the middle ground between good taste and terrible judgment, between flops and fiascos, and it lies between the pit of puny man-animal's fears and the summit of Oogie Love's knowledge. This is the dimension of grudging toleration. It is an area which we call Nathan Raven's Happy Cast. Listeners, and welcome to the latest episode of Nathan Rabin's Happy Cast. I, alas, am not Nathan Rabin. I am, in fact, Clint Worthington, a film and TV writer for Consequence of Sound and editor-in-chief of The Spool.
And my name is Nathan Rabin of Nathan Rabin's Happy Place and Nathan Rabin's Happy Cast. And if you say Shazam, I remain the same person. I am. No magic involved there.
See, if I say Shazam, I turn into Clue Gulager, which I think is a lateral move.
And I turn into Sinbad, which is kind of cultural appropriation. It's very weird and very awkward. I try and get people to not say that. I was kind of hoping for the superhero thing. I turn out to be kind of a middling veteran stand-up comedian.
If I say Shazam, I just turn into Gomer Pyle.
Oh, there you go.
Shazam!
I think
wasn't he kind of a superhero in his own right? He had that beautiful singing voice. People don't talk about that.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
He seemed like a goober, literally, but he had a beautiful singing voice.
Oh yeah, Jim Neighbors, excellent singer.
Yeah, absolutely. But he unfortunately is not guesting on this podcast.
No. Instead you get me.
Instead you get you. And who are you, perchance?
My name is, my entertainment name is
Do you even go to the school?
Ian. I'm just playing hooky, clearly. My name is Insane Ian. I am a comedy musician, is best termed that. And I do weird things on the internet like most people nowadays.
Now, your Twitter handle says, yes, you're the person from that one song you've heard of. What is that song?
That song would either be Dig Dug, which is my parody of Kesha's TikTok about old school video games, or it would be a song called Benedict Cumberbatch, which was the number one song on the Dr. Demento show for the year 2015.
That is impressive.
Well, we're very happy to have you here, both
and
for...
And what was Benedict Cumberbatch about?
It was about penguins.
you mean penguins.
Penguins, exactly. Penguins. Thank you for catching my reference.
Yes, I do what I can. I watch a lot of Graham Norton show.
Completely understandable.
Yes. But we're glad to have you here, both to talk about Weird Al, and also before that, we're gonna have a rather super episode for the kiddies out there, talking about some more youth oriented Caped Crusader films, which makes me sound so old to say that.
Well, watching these movies made
what the
me
whippersnappers
feel old
are up to at the Nickelodeons these days.
Gee whiz, sir.
Sorry, I have to pick up my monocle after it popped up out of my eye. But we're going to talk about the DC movie Shazam! Exclamation point, and Sky High, of all things. Just movies about kids trying to be superheroes.
Exactly. Yeah. 14, 15-year-old superheroes. There aren't a lot of them. That also have kind of this winning, charming, innocent, old-school Disney quality to them.
Yeah, absolutely.
So, yeah.
For sure.
Especially since one is by Disney. So, you know, that makes it convenient.
That works. Sure. Yeah, I guess that fits into the thing. Well, it's one of those things. We'll talk about it a little more later. But I watched it for the first time this weekend. So thank you for that.
Oh.
For a Disney movie, it feels like a Disney Channel movie, which I thought was very interesting.
A little bit.
Yeah,
I can see a little bit. There's something. It's very brightly lit. It's very cheerful. There are lots of catchy pop songs, which are
Michael Angarano.
I would imagine
absolutely the kind of kid who would star in a Disney Channel show.
Yes,
definitely.
At that age. Yeah, but before we go into those things, we should talk about the Patreon, patreon.com/ Nathan Ravens
and our crushing failure,
that is currently plummeting like a stone. No new patrons.
Do you have more than 14 patrons?
We do, I believe.
Then you're doing better than mine.
That's fair. And I legit, I have so many Patreons, I almost said the Patreon for the spool. Patreon.com/thespool, which only has a mere 23. But yeah, so please
pledge. Well, you do like to say, I pity the fool who does not pledge to the spool. Which indeed. I think is a great, great slogan. I don't know why it's not bringing more money to your...
You know what?
Page.
I'll adopt it someday. But in the meantime, if you don't want to give money to me directly, you can give money to me indirectly by pledging to the HappyCast Patreon. We'll give you bonus stuff at some point, but it's mostly just to keep the lights on. We really, really appreciate all your support. So please, please, for the love of God, please give us money. When you're not busy giving money to Nathan's amazing successful Kickstarter for the weird accordion to Al.
Although you got a big, big, big tax refund this year. Every single last one of you. You're probably like, I have so much money. I have too much money. What should I do with it?
Yeah, this Trump's economy just blowing up. Yeah, for sure. He's got plenty of money to throw around. Anyways, so please do that. And now that we've alienated all our MAGA audience, unfortunately, that's, you know, more's the pity, you know, good riddance. But anyway, without further ado, let's actually get started. Before I dig myself further into this verbal hole, let's talk about Shazam.
When you say it, you must give the emphasis that you are including the exclamation point at the end.
Yes.
I think that's important.
I feel like you need to like pump your arms when you say you're Shazam.
Definitely.
Shazam.
Shazam. I do jazz
not
hands.
Even,
is that proper?
Not even pumping your fist, just raising it to the sky. Shazam.
Shazam. I don't know. This isn't a Slayer concert, but you know.
No, but it's you're not throwing your horns, but it's a fist
no.
to the sky.
It's so more Ultraman than
absolutely. It's 100% Ultraman. Absolutely.
What are the big divides here on the podcast? Is that Clint is a total nerd, and
yes,
I make fun of him a lot for that. And I'm a cool guy and a jock, so I don't know about things like comic books or superheroes. So one of you fine gentlemen, tell me a little something about Shazam.
Yeah. All right. So this is the...
Most of my songs are about comic books, so yeah, it's fine.
No, it's fine. You can take it. You can take it.
Yeah, for sure.
No, I wasn't saying to take it. I'm saying this is definitely I'm on the right show is what I'm saying.
Oh, okay, good. Well, I'm very glad to have you here. So yeah, Shazam is kind of the latest in like the DCEU's 3-film attempt to rehabilitate their entire franchise by... At first, their problem was they were trying to do exactly what the Marvel Cinematic Universe was doing and having all these interconnected things. And now with Shazam, I mean, they're sort of cribbing from like the Marvel's lighter tone, but they're also doing a lot more standalone stuff and taking these weird, crazier risks. And with Shazam, the risk is let's just make the Goonies, but with a superhero kid.
Let's make the Goonies meets Big.
Yeah, let's make it happen with, like, capes and shit. It'll be fine. So, yeah, this follows young Billy Batson, played by some actor I don't know the name of right now. But
Asher
yeah,
something.
He was Asher Angel. Oh, my God, that happened. Oh, my God, it just came from my mind palace. And anyway, he's a foster kid sort of running around from home to home, sort of halfway searching for his birth mother who sort of, you know, he lost as a young child. And he ends up going to this foster family in Philly. And he ends up inadvertently getting the powers of this old wizard played by a guy who was in the other Captain Marvel movie that came out this year, Jimin Hansu. But he has to say the word Shazam. And when he does, he grows into like kind of an adult version of himself with like cartoonish padded muscle suit and like a red tights and a cape.
I think the idea is that it's the best possible version of himself.
Yeah.
So
yeah.
This is him living his best life and looking as good as he possibly
yeah.
can. Sort of
right.
like, so, I look as good as I can possibly can. This is the 10 out of 10 version of the rough play.
Right. And so over the course of the film, and obviously this is a person, like we see before Billy gets his powers that the wizard Shazam is looking for like someone who is just absolutely virtuous, like the peak platonic ideal of virtue. But out of necessity,
pure
he has
heart.
To give it to this deeply flawed, yeah, pure of heart. Mm-hmm. But out of necessity, he has to give it to this flawed, angry, resentful because sometimes spiteful kid. And so this movie dares to ask, this movie dares to have the message, the superhero film of with great power comes great responsibility. I thought that was a very new, fun message.
Yeah, we haven't heard that before.
No, not at all. But it does present it in a fun, interesting way where I love, I mean, it's a much lighter film than the others in the DCEU. I mean, there was in a different way than like the candy coated Flash Gordon spectacle of Aquaman, which I still kind of really love.
I think Aquaman, like Venom, is a lot of fun. It's also incredibly stupid. I feel like it can be incredibly entertaining and bad and dumb. And I feel like Venom and Aquaman both really nail that whole good yet terrible, fun.
If they turn into the skid of the stupid and kind of own it, it makes it more enjoyable to me.
So yeah, and then with Shazam, there is this. It feels so old fashioned in this charming way. It feels like a movie straight out of the 80s, 90s. The kind of Amblin Spielberg kind of school of stuff, where it's at the end of the day, it's about this group of kids learning to form this community and sort of fighting off these very adult instincts towards cynicism and nihilism and stuff. I found it very charming. It was a very charming movie.
I just wanted to say that I am a white heterosexual male. So I'm not exactly lacking for representation when it comes to any kind of media, television, movies, that kind of stuff, particularly with superhero stuff. But I grew up in a group home. From the time I was 14 to the time I was 19 years old, I was a ward of the Jewish Children's Bureau. And one of the things that made it agonizing and terrible and very, very lonely was I felt like there was no representation of what I was going through on screen. I felt like group home kids, foster kids, kids who did not have parents, they were either Orphan Annie or they were Gary Coleman and in Different Strokes. And like, this is very different. Like, I don't live with a bunch of rich people. I'm not a black kid who, you know, lives with white people to make people feel like, you know, we've come further racially than we have. So one of the nice things about this was sort of like with Short Term 12 as well, was obviously this is fantastical. Obviously, this is very silly. Obviously, this is a superhero movie. But I'm like, this is kind of who I was when I was 15 years old, except for being good looking and having friends and superpowers. I basically just masturbated a lot. but if I could have become a superhero, it would have been really amazing. So for me, I think, you know, this resonated on that level. And I think that's also something that this brings to the table that other superhero movies do not. Even Short Term 12, which stars Captain Marvel.
Right, and I think you'll be very pleased by the Shazam extended cut, which features so many scenes of Billy Batson just furiously masturbating in his foster home, often in the Shazam suit. So.
Hashtag realism.
Hashtag realism. Yeah,
he couldn't figure out how to pee, but he definitely figured out how to stroke it.
Yes, exactly. That's the Snyder cut.
You guys
or uncut
saying the
or
other,
uncut we don't
guys,
know
yes well that's true it suit wasn't that tight yeah. You keep saying the other Captain Marvel, but you did not actually establish that in the comics Shazam was originally called Captain Marvel.
We know our
audience.
Before
so this
Marvel
was Captain
Comics,
Marvel,
that,
but not from Marvel. That is very
yes,
very
exactly.
confusing to me that there was a Captain Marvel who wasn't part of Marvel.
Yes.
Yeah, it was by a Fawcett Comics, which then got sued by DC Comics because Captain Marvel was too similar to Superman. They sued them, they got the rights to it, they kept the rights, didn't do anything with the character. Marvel, the copyright, I think, lapsed on the name. Marvel snatched up the name Captain Marvel, and so DC still had Captain Marvel but couldn't call him Captain Marvel on the title of the books. But could call him in the issues Captain Marvel. It was very weird. And then they just kind of like rolled it into just being called Shazam.
So then, yeah, so then where does this fit then in sort of the understanding of, because I never read the Shazam comics. Like, how
this
closely
is actually
does that to this?
A fairly close adaptation of the New 52 run of Shazam. A couple years ago, maybe about five, actually probably almost 10 years ago, DC did a soft reboot of their comics after an event called Flashpoint, where all the superhero comics that you were reading went back in time kind of to where we're reading about them being mostly newer superheroes. Batman had only been Batman for about 5 years. Superman had arrived not long ago. And so we got a brand new run of Shazam where Billy Batson first became Shazam in the New 52 run of it. And this storyline for the movie really closely follows and emulates that first run of the first couple of issues of the New 52 version.
Did either of you familiar with the 1970s version of Captain
the
Marvel,
one with Michael Gray?
Shazam.
The TV yes. show?
Oh, yes. The TV show? I've seen like bits and pieces.
It's an interesting thing. It's very pseudo-educational. And,
oh my God. I find that offensive. Don't try and teach people with this garbage. You don't even entertain them, let alone try and entertain them and educate them at the same time.
Yeah, and it's also very much a product of the network versus the product of the license holder, because there's crossovers with ISIS, which was on the same channel, but like has nothing to do with DC Comics at all. not the ISIS that we know now, the ISIS, okay. The female superheroine that had a TV show in the 70s.
Gotcha. See, now I'm picturing the other thing.
No, this is an Egyptian-themed superheroine that crossed over into the Shazam TV show because they were on the same network.
Well, it seems
not
like
a DC
kind of
character
the,
at all.
The overwhelming take of TV shows that were adapting either DC or Marvel heroes in the 1970s is, this is incredibly stupid for babies. Let's not make this any better than it absolutely needs to be. It feels like that was behind Spider-Man as well.
That was definitely the theory behind Spider-Man.
Doctor Strange?
They kind of abandoned by the time they got to Hulk. So
yes, Japanese Spider-Man, on the other hand, was
phenomenal.
A messenger from hell. Like, I believe that's his call
sign. He's the emissary. Yeah. He's the
emissary of hell.
Well, my favorite Spider-Man thing is apparently when Dino De Laurentiis had the rights, or maybe it was canon, had the rights to Spider-Man. I think it was actually Dino De Laurentiis who thought that Spider-Man was actual spider that had male-like properties. So it was a literal cross between a man and a spider, not a whole man who has spider-like qualities. The qualities of a man-sized spider, to use a phrase that turns up in my son's books over and over again.
Excellent. But back to Shazam. We should just talk about kind of the core of the movie, which just feels like there's a little bit of a hangout movie quality to this. Like, just seeing what happens when a kid gets superpowers and what he would do. And I loved that the first instinct Billy Batson has as soon as I'm like, oh, I look like an adult, let's buy some fucking beer.
Yeah,
it was great. Well, because this movie was directed by David F. Sandberg, who did Lights Out. He's much more of a horror guy.
Only his third movie, which I thought was very impressive.
It's very young, assured.
Relatively inexperienced guy. And this is just such a confident film.
Yeah, it really seems like DC's new thing where they're kind of like abandoning the idea of the quote-unquote DCEU and are moving to revamp it as Worlds of DC, that they're hiring horror directors. Aquaman was directed by James Wan, who's a horror director too.
Yeah. And then also, of course, did Furious 7.
Yes, but he also did a Fast movie, yes. But he's more known for The Conjuring and the Annabelle movies and all that, so yeah.
Right.
I have not seen Lights Out or Annabelle Creation, but one of the things that I found really, really interesting about this was I felt like there definitely is a bit of a horror element to it, you know?
Especially in the first scene.
It's
very tonal shifting, man.
The whole shit with the fucking wizard and the monsters and the demons. I feel like that's one of the things that makes this a great movie for children, is that there is a bunch of shit that will freak the fuck out of children. You know, when I think back, like my favorite movies from my childhood, I'm thinking like Large Marge from Pee Wee's Big Adventure.
Yeah.
That scared the shit out of me. That gave me nightmares. I still can't stop thinking about that. And that's, I don't know, top 10 favorite moments of any film. I mean, My son wasn't. I tried to watch Sky High with him, and he's 4 years old. He loved the superhero parts. The fact that it feels like a teen movie, he did not love. And this is a weird thing where it's like, I want my son to see Shazam. I think he'll really, really dig it. I think there's some stuff in there that will really, really frighten him, deservedly so. Yeah. And that's part of its aesthetic, is it's very kid friendly, but it will also, you know, fuck with your mind and show you things that will be hard to forget.
Yeah, it definitely felt like a big tonal disconnect. Like, all the advertisements are these bright, kind of kid-geared visuals. And then, like, when you see the movie, there are some very, very dark, disturbing imagery that they show that's really kind of pushing that PG-13 rating they've got. The opening of the movie and between what becomes the villain and, you know, the accident there, and then when he's grown up, what he does to his... Do we do spoilers here?
You know, as long as we don't reveal, like, the very, very end.
Sure, sure. So what he does to his assistant who's trying to help him locate the Shazam wizard, what happens to her in the opening of the movie, and just certain things of it that are kind of horrific to see, especially if you're a kid expecting a movie that's kind of kid-geared, you know? It was definitely weird tonal shifts.
Right, and yet it still feels more it feels more earned in kind of an adult way than like the sort of forced nihilism of like a Zack Snyder movie where like the whole Man of Steel, Batman, Superman thing. Like that's an adolescent form of maturity where it thinks everything has to be dark and serious and take you know, do you believe?
Forced nihilism is the perfect autobiography title for Zack Snyder. I think that's perfect. Yeah.
You don't get it, man. Batman just kills people, okay? Get it together.
And I think the idea of this whole kind of revision as a gritty superhero movies, which I think had a certain place at a certain point in time. I think, you know, Tim Burton's Batman was important. You know, certainly Christopher Nolan's Batman and The Dark Knight were very, very good. But that kind of implies there has to be something to rebel against. There has to be something to revise. And we've gotten to a point where the vast majority of the superhero movies, it seems, are done for adults. I mean, I kind of feel like, you know, back when I worked at The Onion at the very, very beginning, we used to joke that, you know, we were going to be the 7 millionth people to write a story called comic books. They're not just for kids anymore. Yeah. I feel like the spectrum has shifted so much that now I could write an article called comic books. They're not just for adults anymore.
They're finally for kids again. And I think that's one of the reasons why Shazam feels like such a breath of fresh air, because it does have that gleeful sense of sort of, you know, childlike exploration, not just of the superhero world, but of like Shazam's powers, like the glee at which Zachary Levi gets to like express like, hey, I can shoot lightning from my fingers. Like that kind of stuff is very infectious. And I love that. I love his dynamic with Jack Dylan Grazer from It. Like that was kind of a fun little back and forth.
Well, yeah, I feel like one of the things that this movie really has that a lot of movies are lacking is a genuine sense of awe. You know, if you turned into a superhero, it would be the most amazing fucking thing in the world. And I feel like too many superhero movies, like, oh, now I can fly. Fuck, what do I do now? Whereas this is like, oh my God, I can fly. I have vision. This is the most amazing thing ever. I really loved Zachary Levi's performance here. I think he really captures the duality of looking like hunk, looking like what you would want to look like, but having the mind of a child or of a teenager and being this disconnect. And watching this, I just wrote about Looney Tunes Back in Action and For a Vengeance. And I was thinking, man, like 10, 15 years ago, Brendan Fraser would have been the perfect Shazam because he has that quality of being you know, very buff and an action hero and an adventurer, but also like a silly kid inside. He kind of had that duality, and I think Zachary Levi has it as well. And yeah, this is a lovable, lovable, incredibly charming, very, very winning performance.
And I love the surprising depths with which they showed Mark Strong's character. Like, I think there's, if there's a criticism I could levy against, I could Levi against Shazam. I know I did that. I is that like I you know the Mark Strong stuff and especially like the seven deadly sins, like the monsters and everything else, like that could have used a little more tweaking, but like for what it was, like I think Mark Strong does these kinds of roles in his sleep, honestly, at this point. Like, it's very Green Lantern, it's very that kind of stuff. Like John Carter, I think he's a similar kind of villain. Yeah. But I appreciated what they did with him in the script, where he is this polar opposite in terms of, like, he's the one who wanted the powers but didn't get them and was punished for not getting them, and then has that resentment built up inside him, much like Billy Batson is resentful for these other reasons and is suddenly had these powers foisted upon him and not really knowing what to do with it. So I love this sort of feeling of stolen valor and who deserves these kinds of, who deserves power, that kind of thing.
Yeah, and it's interesting to me that this is such a huge, huge movie, because if you look at it, like, Shazam is not a character that people know terribly well. Captain Marvel, even the other Captain Marvel, confusingly not hugely known. The villain here is Dr. Savannah, which is, again, not something that people know. I mean, you're kind of talking about a lesser-known superhero, a lesser-known villain, and it works all the same. And yeah, I agree. I feel like comic book villains work a lot better when they have when they're right on some level, when they have legitimate reasons to be angry, legitimate reasons to hate the world, legitimate reasons to be incredibly envious and aggressive towards the heroes. And I feel like that's definitely here. And yeah, he's definitely not reimagining his persona or anything. But yeah, I felt like he was very, very strong.
And I love when those motivations tie in thematically to the hero. Like, it reminded me of Vulture in Spider-Man Homecoming, where they're both tackling this similar problem of what happens when the little guy suddenly exists in a world of gods and monsters, where Peter's answer to that is to look up to them and aspire to be them, whereas the Vulture is resentful at what has been taken away from him by these elites, you know, and sort of has to go his own way. And I think that Savannah and Shazam sort of work on a similar level, though maybe not as well as in Homecoming for me.
Especially even in their motivations, I think there's a lot of duality between that, because Billy Batson, Shazam, is looking for his home. He's looking for his actual family, not the adoptive family, which he then does go in and embrace. But he is looking for his mother that he lost all those years ago. And meanwhile, Dr. Savannah is outright thinks that, you know, family is useless because his family was so vile and abusive to him. So It's there's also the duality in their motivations too, which I really, really dig.
Right. And then the way they're able to, I love the way the foster home was presented too. Like, you get just enough of those like ultra supportive foster parents. Like, they don't really need to be three dimensional characters, but they're almost like criminally, like unrealistically, like perfect. Yeah. You know, yeah. It's kind of, it's like being
like,
raised
I
by two youth pastors,
like,
you know?
Yeah.
Yeah.
What I discovered is usually people there, they have weird power trips. They want to be in a position of power over vulnerable teenagers. And I feel like that's kind of the cliche and the stereotype as well. So it was very nice to see, like, oh, they're just loving people. And yeah, I liked how diverse this was. I liked how, you know, there are different races, different ethnicities, kind of anybody can be a hero. I feel like, yeah, it's very empowering. I feel like I've seen so many stories about white dudes who become superheroes, and it's fucking boring. It's nice to see other groups represented, including group home kids. We've been shut out of the superhero world for too long.
Right, and all kinds of different body types, too. I mean, because there's also, you know, that one kid who's overweight, and then, like, there's... I love that little sister. She was so great and so charming. Yeah, Darla, who keeps it a little secret. Like, and, you know, they end up playing into the larger story in some unexpected ways, which I was so relieved they didn't reveal in the marketing. I feel like it would easy to, like, have toys revealed and things like that.
Although I remember seeing, like, Adam Brody was in the cast. I'm like, oh, I wonder who Adam Brody's playing. I wonder who superstar Adam Brody is in this motion picture. You will find out when you see this movie.
We were saying how standalone this is. I love that this movie kind of exists in the periphery of these other movies. Like, you know, you just see it mostly through, like, batarang replicas and newspapers and, like, people, you know, keeping bullets that were bounced off Superman. Like, I like the way that the existence of superheroes in Shazam creates this entire economy in the world of this that is sort of touched upon in, like, his, you know, the kid's love of superheroes and all that kind of stuff.
That's kind of how Shazam becomes a hero, is he starts making money posing for photos because you're meeting a superhero, so here, pay me money.
Yeah, it's like
that's how a kid would do it.
Yeah, it's like what street is it in LA where all the fake superheroes hang out? Is it like Rodeo? That's not Rodeo Drive. But it's
is it like Grauman's Chinese theater? Right? Is it?
Yeah, it's in front of Chinese theater. But it's like, yeah, it's like the real superpower. It's like if they had actual superpowers. But I love the way that blows up in his face, too, where his hubris sort of, you know, gets the best of him, and suddenly he's thrust into some real heroic situations, and he has to learn not to look out for numero uno, you know?
Yeah, even though he gives that advice to one of the other foster kids to marry.
Yeah, exactly. Who wants to leave, but who can leave but doesn't want to because her family environment is so loving, which felt novel to me. Yeah.
Right?
Yeah, very much so. That is the inverse of how it usually goes.
Yeah, it's true. It's true. And then also there are those little, like, superhero movie nods. Like, there are jokes about villains giving big speeches and that kind of thing. And I thought that was charming enough, and it wasn't too overused. I was reminded, it felt like the climax felt a little like Gremlins,
Yeah, I could definitely get that vibe.
Yeah,
I kind of got just a vibe of Tom Hanks in Big the entire movie.
Yeah, for sure. Well, they have the piano bit, especially the piano bit,
because that was more intentional than anything else. But yeah, just the whole thing of him, like, hey, I'm adult sized now. Let me do adult things. It really struck me as hilarious and kind of very much in the vein of that. And it definitely seemed like they used that as a influence.
Oh, yeah. Well, there's also an element of him being 15 years old and an adolescent. And when you're an adolescent, your body is evolving and changing in weird and exciting and confusing ways that lead you to masturbate constantly. I think this is kind of commenting upon that, where what if your body could do more than just produce ejaculate from constant masturbation? What if you were a superhero and you could save people?
What if your body was more than just a cum machine? You could masturbate
while flying. There's so many different ways that you could masturbate if you were a superhero.
I'm really glad they dropped the cum dumpster subtitle from the name of the movie.
Shazam cum dumpster.
Shazam whacking it in the sky. Is that Shazam? Whoa, no.
Fair warning, one of these is going to be the episode title. Just letting you know right off the bat.
Kind of figured.
Yeah.
It's hard to beat Spider-Man for teenage masturbatory metaphors. I mean, he's a dude literally just sticks sticky shit out of his hands, and that's his superhero.
And is always sticky, yeah.
Yeah, that wasn't really my superhero when I was a teenager, if you catch my drift. So there's something kind of wonderful.
So that's what homecoming meant.
Hi-ho.
Way-o.
Ba-dum-bum-bum-bum. But yeah, so I think there's just something nice about the idea that, you know, hey, superheroes, they're for kids sometimes.
Yeah, they're not just for adults.
Absolutely. Do we have any other thoughts on Shazam? It's just sort of generally like, it's just generally really charming and really fun. Really long? But you don't really feel that super much, which I found surprising.
Yeah, I didn't feel like it was over long.
Yeah, it's like Terrence Malick film long.
It dealt with a lot of stuff, you know? Yeah. It was full. I wasn't like, oh man, this movie is too short, but it didn't feel overly long, excessively long.
It's good stuff. I love that the movie embraces, like, the movie feels like it has an exclamation point in the title. Like, I love that kind of gee whiz sensibility to it. So go see Shazam. I love it. It's weird to be in a space where, like, we're more excited about new DC movies coming out than, like, the latest in the Marvel machine, where, like, the Marvel machine has, like, created this baseline level of competence where, like, I love the Marvel movies. They're a lot of fun. I find them tremendously rewatchable, but I think it's because they're so sort of blandly consistent for the most part. Like, you know what you're getting. And so when things like Shazam come along, or even Aquaman, it's a surprise.
Yeah, and with stuff like Endgame, I feel like just so much has been going into it that it's almost overwhelming. You know, where I'm almost like, oh, there are like 78 fucking, like, not even exaggerating, 78 superheroes. You know, 3.5 hour long length. Like, I know this is going to be good and interesting and a lot going on, but yeah. I'm already exhausted by Endgame, and I haven't watched it yet.
Yeah, exactly. All right, well, let's move on. Okay, so this was Control Nathan and Clint, right? What were our options this time around?
I believe you were the person who suggested the other motion picture, which was a superhero movie directed by Manny Coto. See, this is how my stupid brain works. I totally remember that Manny Coto, 24 producer and the director of Dr. Giggles, the doctor is out, period, 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 of his mind. The doctor is in... period, 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 insane. But he also did a motion picture entitled, that I totally remember, I don't need to see. That movie was called...
Was it Star Kid?
Star Kid, yes.
Yes!
Star Kid from 1997.
I forgot that I suggested Star Kid to you. I don't know why my brain went to Star Kid when I was watching Shazam, but it did.
Now, have you seen the movie Star Kid?
Oh, I recorded that. There was a gossamer year growing up in high school where my parents had like pirate satellite DirecTV. They had the card you could put in the little DirecTV thing, where we got all the pay-per-view movies for free. So everything in the year 1999, I just like recorded on a VHS, and one of them was Star Kid. So I have like probably like a triple layer VHS, like one of the 6 hour long things of like Star Kid, Good Burger, and Wing Commander. That's like probably like that tells you as much as you need to know about my film tastes as a precious teenager. But yeah, Star Kid featured Yeah, Tim from Jurassic Park.
Joe Mazzella.
In a robo suit.
Yeah,
but that was the option that didn't end up making it. So don't worry.
Yeah, I'd actually
talk about
never even heard of Starkid. So.
Oh, man. It's what happens if Joseph Mazzello from Jurassic Park gets, like, finds an alien exosuit and sort of does, like, a pre-Iron Man thing?
So it's the greatest American hero meets Iron Man.
Pretty much, yeah. But that's not the movie we're talking about, unfortunately, to my great dismay, even though the other movie's pretty solid, too. What's the other one we're talking about?
The other one is Sky High from 2005.
Yeah, which I didn't even... I keep getting that confused with Zoom! Exclamation point, the one that had
they're
the
very
similar. The same year.
That's like the Dante's Peak
good.
To yeah. Sky High's Volcano.
Yeah, one was very good and one exactly. was terrible. In a related development, one of them starred Tim Allen.
Yes. And the other one stars Kurt Russell and Kelly Preston, of all people, as superheroic parents to young Michael Angarano, who was like the kid who was in all these kinds of movies in the 2000s. I remember him from The Forbidden Kingdom, that Jackie Chan Jet Li movie where like he grows up, where he like gets sucked back into ancient China. And is the white kid
yeah.
to go on like a big wuxia adventure.
I remember him most from a motion picture he did where he was a child dying of cancer and his dying wish was to fuck a porn star. Wyclef Jean plays a magical cab driver in this
motion
picture.
Of course he does.
Yeah, I feel like I should watch this again because it's a fucking nightmare and amazing and terrible. And again, let's not over-sexualize teenagers even if they're dying.
Yes, especially if they're dying. Ian, why don't you tell us the story of Sky High?
So Sky High is the parents are Kurt Russell and Kelly Preston. Like you said, they are superheroes. They are always off saving the city, and they have a son played by the actor's name you said, whose name eludes me. And yeah, that dude. And yeah. So it's. They are sending him to the high school where they went to high school, which is a high school for superheroes. It's where superheroes learn how to be superheroes. And so they send him off to this high school, him and his best friend who lives next door, who also has superpowers, but he doesn't know what his powers are yet. His superpowers haven't developed yet. So
he's a late bloomer, if you will.
Well, he's a late hero bloomer.
Well, he's 14 years old, so his superpowers mainly involve just masturbating constantly.
Of course. Clearly.
They imply
as
that,
we're going
but
with
they, don't,
theme.
They don't establish
he's a
that.
Budding
it's
cum
PG.
Machine, yeah.
Yes. A budding, that's great.
A burgeoning cum machine.
So he's trying to establish what his powers could be. Is he going to be a hero, or because he doesn't have any powers, is he going to end up being a sidekick his whole life? And his parents, who are very well-known superheroes, which is kind of how he got into the school and how he has such a notoriety is because of his parents. So he's kind of like trying to get out of their shadow, but also kind of establish himself as something, but he doesn't know what his powers are yet. And there's an overarching villain theme going with that too. It's super fun. There's a ton of people from Kids in the Hall in it, which is great.
That's great, just, yeah.
There's so many references to other superhero genre things while this not being a typical superhero genre thing and just references galore by having Linda Carter be the principal of the school. It's just great.
Bruce Campbell portrays the gym teacher
which is upsetting short shorts.
Yeah, who's a superhero, I guess, superhero known as Sonic Boom, but he's kind of a loser and he never really cut it. So he just kind of devotes his energy towards being overly hostile and negative towards actual superheroes, which I find strangely true to at least how I experienced the school system of Chicago.
Now, were you classed by the sorting hat? I mean, I'm sorry, Coach Boomer, into being a hero or a sidekick?
I would the third category, compulsive masturbators.
Oh, God damn it.
But I do. You mentioned Kids in the Hall. Yeah, this is one of my all time favorite Dave Foley performances. It's up there with The Wrong Guy and Postal, where he plays the all American boy. And again, it's just so perfect for Dave Foley because he was so boyish and so cute, and it's like, oh, he's gonna look like an adorable 17-year-old for his entire life. Cut to, he had a lot of decades of hard living, sadness, failure. You know, it makes him more relatable. So the idea that he just kind of has reconciled himself to this sort of sad existence as a gym teacher, kind of pining for this time when, you know, he was out there actually being a hero himself. So yeah, it's a very funny performance, but there's also a real element of sadness and kind of melancholy to it as well, which I really, really enjoyed.
Yeah. Right. Along with Kevin MacDonald, who is the kind of, was it Mr. Medulla? Who is the mad
science teacher.
Yeah, which is pretty great. It's the perfect kind of egghead. Because, I mean, I don't even think they needed to put a prosthetic on Kevin MacDonald's head. His just forehead is just that long. but he and Dave Foley actually get a few fun moments together, which is always really cool to see. Those things are really great. I found myself really charmed by this one. I think I was always sort of skeptical of it because I think it came out like right when I sort of felt like I had outgrown those movies for babies. I think its glitzy sort of superhero aesthetic works greatly in its favor. I found a lot to enjoy about it.
Well, it kind of has the feeling to me, and I'm sure this was kind of over, you know, Kurt Russell began his career in Disney live action movies. Like, he was a child star. And he appeared in all these movies that were incredibly stupid and pretty dumb, but probably pretty entertaining as well. So this
I feel like in the yearbook, when we see like a young Kurt Russell, it almost looks like a still from like the Computer Wore Tennis Shoes or something like that.
My God, that Kurt Russell, he's had a fucking amazing life. Do you guys know that his dad was owned the only like independent minor league baseball team?
Wow.
And the Kurt Russell was a fucking minor league baseball player in between being a child star with Disney and Elvis Presley and like the coolest guy in the world as an adult. Like, in between, he was on his dad's fucking minor league baseball team.
That's wild.
He's pretty fucking cool.
Kurt Russell.
And he's great. Like, he's very ideally cast here as like very wholesome, you know, and he has amazing presence and is very paternal and obviously really, really loves his son. Albeit in a way that, you know, sometimes makes his son feel bad and shitty. And yeah, I felt Agarino had hit the right note between being kind of a schmuck and feeling sorry for himself and not knowing if he can really rise to the challenge, literally and metaphorically. But at the same time, you know, being somebody who has this potential within him.
Yeah. And I mean, I love the sort of blind spot that Kurt Russell has towards him, too, where like even when he sort of fucks up and make, you know, but then he, you know, he gets taken into the secret sanctum and immediately the response isn't to punish him, but to hug him because he finally got his powers and he's just so excited. And so I think
he got his powers, but that his powers are the same as his.
Yeah, exactly. Like, because there was always there's this sort of mythology within the world of Sky High about like whether you get superpowers, what you get superpowers from, like being a child of someone with one person with superpowers or two. That kind of thing. Like, we get that explanation from like the one scene wonder with Cloris Leachman as the nurse, who's just great in that scene.
I was like, why does she look familiar? I was like, oh yeah, that's fucking acting legend Cloris Leachman.
Yeah,
as Nurse Spex.
Yeah, she's so great. So there's a lot of surprising, like, I dare to say, depth in there about a lot of things to say about like legacy, the idea of like legacy students. And like, it's funny to watch this after like the Yale admissions scandal, because I kind of imagine how that would work here. Just having people like cheat at Save the Citizen or whatever. Like,
Yeah. Well, there's a great line.
It's like Bruce Wayne paying to have Damian go to the school. He doesn't have any powers, but I don't want to put him in the sidekick program.
Right, exactly.
There's a great line that Michael Agarino says where he goes, if life suddenly decided to start getting fair, high school would be a bizarre place for it. Yeah. And I'm sure I'm completely slaughtering that, but it's so true. I mean, fucking high school is terrible and weird and you feel like you don't belong and you're a mutant and you're crazy and you're different from everybody else. And in here, that is the case. And it is a good thing and a bad thing. And there are so many elements of it that are just very clever and very winningly conceived. I mean, the fact that the school is an outer, you know, floats, you know, so that it's a flying school in space so that, you know, villains won't be able to get to it. You know, there's this whole world that they kind of built up around it. Kevin Heffernan from Broken Lizard has a very funny supporting role as a bus driver.
Ron Wilson,
bus driver. Yeah, very, very good. Jim Rash
Yeah, Oscar-winning screenwriter, Jim Rash. Screenwriter.
Very, very good. And then we also have Mary Elizabeth Winstead. The lovely, lovely and charming Mary Elizabeth Winstead as... and again, I think the one element that didn't necessarily work gangbusters for me is it kind of felt like the love triangle element of it, the teen romance element of it. I felt like that felt a little bit stock. That didn't work as well as the others. But not because, you know, Mary Elizabeth Winstead did anything wrong. I think it's just... we've seen this before, and no matter how charming and appealing these actors are, it feels a little bit stock.
Yeah, sure. That felt like a sort of vestigial element of, like, this still needs to be a teen high school movie, albeit with all these Definitely. Other trappings, so, like, they still had to, like, have that stuff there. And, like, you know, and then Layla's played by Danielle Panabaker, who's actually on The Flash right now, so she's still doing the superhero beat. I thought she was perfectly charming here. She has good chemistry with Michael Angarano and all that stuff. I forget who plays the glowy kid. Is that anyone we recognize?
He was in another Disney movie called Prom, playing basically the same character.
Okay. Because he looked like a shrunken Tom Green. That was kind of where I ended up falling on that. I was like, wait, how early is this? It's kind of a very stealing Harvard performance. Speaking of the Yale admission scandal, it's very much a high school movie before it is a superhero movie, because the superhero like plot ends up playing in at the very, very end. And that almost kind of feels rote, even though it ties in thematically into these sort of like generational resentments that end up, you know, the sins of the father kind of being revisited on the son kind of stuff.
Well, it also feels very true to very true to teen movies, and that it all climaxes at a high school dance.
Yeah, yeah.
And it's also very much the teen movie in that the outcasts end up being the heroes of the picture. In this case, quite literally, it is the sidekicks, the people from the sidekick class, who are actually the heroes of the day rather than the people who are training to be the actual superheroes.
Oh, holy shit. I just realized where I recognize the glowy kid from. Do you guys watch the HBO show Succession, the Adam McKay thing?
I do.
He's He's this great bumbling kind of outsider into this sort of like Camelot-esque business family, and he's great in that. Good to see him getting work. But yeah, speaking of outcasts too, I also want to nerd out a little bit too and say that the main appeal for me as a giant turbo nerd is that the kid who plays War and Peace,
best name ever.
Right? I love that the Wikipedia thing, make sure that you know that the name is a play on War and Peace.
Wait, like, what?
They have to spell it out. But he's played by Stephen Strait, who is actually the lead right now on my very favorite TV show, The Expanse, formerly Sci-Fi, now Amazon. So it's interesting to see him like as the...
Wait,
the
he's Jim Holden?
Yeah, he's Jim Holden. Well, the Jim, the very
oh my
same.
God.
So it's fun to see him because, I mean, he definitely gives that kind of performance where, like, he's definitely a teen model starting to become an actor, but he kind of still gives that performance, to be honest. But I found him really fun. It is kind of a weird feeling to see him in 2019, like, be in a Chinese restaurant and, like, speak sort of half-hearted Chinese to an actual Asian actress.
I thought he was a minority upon looking at IMDb. Oh hell no,
he's this is a New York Italian guy.
Yeah, he's half English and half Italian.
Yeah, so whoops. Didn't catch that one earlier.
Adler.
Oh, there you go. That's good.
Before becoming a male model,
he was also in that movie about like sexy teen bro witches called like The Covenant or whatever, the one that had like Taylor Kitsch and Sebastian Stan in it. Like he's like the good one in that one. I don't know. Anyway, I found him really fun here. He's like, he has that beautiful smolder and like the long like early aughts hair and like the red stripe and the leather jacket. He was the bad boy. But I liked his little kind of journey. That's what I have to say about him. I like people from The Expanse.
Yeah, and it's interesting to me because this came out in 2005, which was kind of a bit of a nowhere land for superhero movies, where, you know, Blade had happened in 97, and then Iron Man wouldn't happen until 2007. So
before Batman Begins, bro.
Yeah, I feel like kind of right before the superhero movie, before the boom began, right before Iron Man kind of kicked everything off. This was, and again, I feel like this probably would have done a lot better in terms of critically, commercially getting a following had it been released during a more superhero obsessed time.
Right. And it also surprised me to see that Michael Giacchino did the score for this. Like, And it's a very Giacchino, it's a very early Giacchino kind of score, like where if you listen to Lost and stuff, it has that kind of muted horn kind of deal. I don't know, I just pay attention to scores a lot, and so it was weird to see like that kind of muscle behind a movie that sort of looks kind of deliberately cheap.
Yeah, I can definitely see that.
It definitely has that kind of, we're going for the gaudy, goofy colors on the superhero outfits kind of aesthetic. I definitely really enjoy the soundtrack to it as well as the score, because yeah. The soundtrack is all 80s songs done
an
by...
an unironic use of They Might Be Giants.
Yeah, that's They Might Be Giants. Exactly. Covering Devo. I'm like, holy shit.
Yes.
This is pushing all my buttons.
Yes, exactly. Yeah, it's a great soundtrack. So,
I thought it was very interesting that you know, because in the end of the final act of all these kinds of superhero movies, that's when like our hero finally gets his outfit, and his outfit, Will's outfit, is just like a white leather jacket that kind of approximates the colors of his parents' outfit.
Yeah.
Yeah, I don't know. What else do we have to say about this one? I just really dug it. I thought it was kind of a charming little teen.
It's super fun, and they were going to do a sequel to it, and never, it didn't do well enough that they carried forth with doing a sequel to it. Like, them in college, I guess, was going to be the idea. But they never carried forth with it. Then they were planning on doing a TV series, and I think they actually planned on doing an actual comic book for it. But
I could totally see this as like a Disney Plus streaming thing, because definitely, I mean, I feel like this definitely has a modest cult following. People genuinely like it. I feel like there's a lot of I'm guessing you could probably get Michael Angarino. Probably a little tougher to get Kurt Russell, you know, he's making that sequel to the Santa Chronicles. But yeah, I could definitely see that working. And then also, this seems like kind of a very goofy, fun kind of version of X-Men. Professor Xavier School for Misfits. What if this was kind of a goofy light comedy instead of being, you know, the sort of science fiction intense melodrama?
Yeah, like what if Xavier's School for Gifted Children was a little less fascistic?
Yeah, well, what if it was like your fucking high school? And that it kind of sucked. And that everything was lame.
Yeah, exactly.
But, you know, superheroes and supervillains.
Exactly. All right, let's move on. So we are here once again to talk about Weird Al Yankovic. Again, a subject new to us, but now we have Ian.
Yes.
Ian, why don't you talk to us? What? Why don't you talk to us about what Weird Al means to you?
Well, Weird Al, I mean, obviously, because my name is Insane Ian, I take a lot of cues from the stuff that Al has done. You know, I grew up listening to his music. I've been a fan for decades, and it kind of shaped what I do in my extracurricular activities. I do comedy songs, both original and parody. I love comedy music. My love of comedy music came from Weird Al and the Dr. Demento show, and it's kind of influenced what I do. I am the only comedy musician to appear on all three Weird Al fan tribute albums.
Ooh.
It helps that I produced the second one myself. But the second one has Chris Ballew from the Presidents of the United States of America on it, so I've got that going for me.
Oh, I say, when did you first see Weird Al?
That's a funny story, because I grew up in Baltimore, Maryland. I live in the Chicagoland area now, but I grew up in Baltimore, and when Off the Deep End came out in 91, he was supposed to do a concert at Hammerjacks, and this would be my first opportunity as a kid to see Weird Al in concert. And the day of the show, it got canceled because they didn't sell enough tickets for it. And he was going to do an autograph session at Steeltown that morning and then do the show at Hammerjacks. And they didn't announce the tickets were going on sale until like the day before or something like that. And because of it, like the show didn't sell well and they canceled the show. And this was the first time I had heard about him coming to my town. So I didn't get a chance to meet him. I didn't get a chance to see him or anything until he did a show at Hershey Park in Pennsylvania a couple years later during the Alapalooza tour, which was two or three years after that. So I finally got to see him when I was out of high school in college numerous times after that. And I've seen him in concert after the two Chicago shows last year, 24 times in concert now. And because I've been on the tribute albums and because I produced one of them myself, I have been backstage and met Al and the band numerous times as well.
Yeah, I actually met you at probably about a year ago to this day at a Weird Al show. It was the first show that I went to for the big self-indulgent vanity tour. And yeah, I mean, that's one of the great things about it was just kind of meeting people. It's kind of like with Fish and Insane Clown Posse. It was like you had an opening gambit conversational-wise no matter what, which for people who might be a little bit awkward, a little bit self-conscious, it's just nice to be able to say like, hey, how many Weird Al shows have you been to? And just... I feel like he's the common denominator between so many people. And I feel like, there's this whole world that's kind of stitched together through Al and kind of along with it, Dr. Demento. And then can you sort of talk about when you started making music yourself? That process.
Yeah, sure. So I had started writing songs in about middle school, probably around 6th, 7th grade. I was writing song parodies, and they were all terrible. They were not good.
Any that stand out in your mind?
My very first one, which was a parody of Aerosmith's "Love in an Elevator," called "Gloves in an Elevator." just the worst thing ever. It was not good. Until I started listening a little bit more to the nuance of why Al did what he did and how Al did what he did. I grew up as a theater kid. My dad was a managing director of a community theater in Baltimore. And so when I would go to the theater with my dad every day and come home and watch Annie's An Evening at the Improv every single night, because it was like, it's 11 o'clock, I'm still wired from being at the theater, let me watch this. And Weird Al hosted one of the episodes of A&E's An Evening at the Improv. And I was unintentionally studying all these stand-up comics, and of course Al as well, while watching this. I didn't know about the Dr. Demento show in my area until I was in high school. I'd always heard about it from The Complete Al, the mockumentary that Al made during Dare to Be Stupid. But I had never actually heard the show myself until years later. But I had been a big fan of comedy and especially Weird Al's music. So I started trying to write my own stuff like that. I didn't really have any success doing it until about 2008. I met some friends outside of college who were musicians. I myself have no actual musical talent. And got them to play my backing tracks for me, be my band, quote unquote. And submitted songs to the Dr. Demento show. But I had tried submitting songs before that in high school. I had my Sega CD game system was a third-party one put out by JVC called the XI. So it was a Genesis, a Sega CD, and a karaoke machine.
Wow. And, that seems like the ultimate nerd device.
Oh, it was my prized possession. And the cool thing about it was it had a button on it that made any disc you put in it karaoke. Basically what it did is it turned down the vocal track or where it thought the vocal track would be in the tracks on the CD, turned that down, boosted everything up, so it essentially made everything karaoke if the disc was recorded properly. If it wasn't, sometimes you'd just get louder vocals and no guitar. But it ended up being... In high school, because I had no musical talent or anybody to be in a band for me, it was how I recorded my first parodies to send to the Dr. Demento show. But as I had always wanted to try to write original songs, not just parodies, because Al also, as we all know, half of his songs are original, half of his songs are parody. And that's kind of the aesthetic I really enjoyed doing, was taking songs and doing pastiches, doing songs that were done in a certain style of another artist that's not a direct parody of one of their songs. And that's something I try to emulate in my own music because I'm such a fan of what he does.
So who are some people that you have done pastiches of?
On my last album, I did a Meatloaf Jim Steinman pastiche. I've done a Rob Zombie pastiche. I'm working on a Real Big Fish pastiche and a Nerf Herder pastiche. I did a country song in the middle of the album last year, or my last album. My last album?
Yeah, that's the country song that you recorded.
The country song I did was called Love Bites. And it was about a guy whose wife leaves him for a vampire. And it's very, very punny. It's very much along the lines of an Al tune. And I also did a Mumford & Sons pastiche called You Might Be, about he thinks his a guy who thinks his girlfriend is a cannibal.
Okay.
The Meatloaf pastiche, because Meatloaf and Jim Steinman have a lot of car imagery in their songs that's used as a euphemism for sex, I thought, let me just take all the innuendo away and make the car euphemisms actually about cars. And it's a it's an almost 8-minute epic song about being stuck in a traffic jam called Rules of the Road.
That's awesome. That's great. Yeah, that's funny. I kind of deep into the process of writing the Weird Accordion to Al, my Facebook group, I think I said, hey, it'd be really cool if Al did a pastiche of Jim Steinman. You know, he's got such a distinctive personality and he's so melodramatic and be perfect. But then somebody pointed out, like, yeah, in Weird Al the book, and they say that Stop Forwarding That Crap to Me is the Jim Steinman pastiche. And I felt like, oh, wow. Nathan Rabin didn't remember that in Nathan Rabin's book, he wrote that. And that's a great pastiche. Like, it's so appropriate.
What a heck.
And it's one of the things that Al does perfectly, which is, you know, the juxtaposition of subject matter and then the sound.
Yeah.
Where the sound is so big and so melodramatic and so crazy, and then the subject matter is so relatable and banal and the stupid shit that people deal with every day. And I feel like when you hit that mark of, yeah, of the individual lines are great, that's wonderful. But yeah, conceptually, there's just something beautiful about, you know, a very beautiful sounding song that's very dark, or very dark song that's very beautiful. That juxtaposition, I think, is really fascinating to me.
Yeah, that's one of the things I really love, and I think he did really, really well on his last studio album, Mandatory Fun. Really had the dichotomy split between what the song subject was and then the style of music that it was done in, and my favorite Al album usually is whatever the newest one is. But, I mean, I still have my absolute favorite, which is always going to be Dare to Be Stupid, because that was the first album I listened to in its entirety first. I was first introduced to Weird Al from Eat It, because a friend of my mom's sang it once, and then my mom went out and found the 45 of it. But, you know, as time grew on, I was like, hey, Dare to Be Stupid is in Transformers the Movie. And now I just found the record of Al's Dare to Be Stupid at the library. Let me copy this onto a tape and wear it the hell out. You know, so that's really where it kind of started for me.
When you're a kid, like, kind of everything is kind of team is connected and everything's kind of put together. And again, kind of the connecting tissue a lot of times is Al, in part because his legacy touches so many other people's legacies. You know, like, yeah, like when Michael Jackson is in the news, like that's a big part of who Al is. I mean, even to the point of, remember hearing that the sort of lead singer of Prodigy had committed suicide. And I'm like, well, that's terrible. It's always horrible and sad when people commit suicide. And then I thought, oh, like 8 entries from now is Al's Firestarter pastiche, Bad Haircut.
Yeah,
And it's going to be very weird writing about that in a melancholy kind of way, because it's very sad what happened to that man. And yeah, just look at all these people who were giants. And yeah, Al has outlasted and outlived a lot of them, if not all of them. He's outlasted and outlived a bunch of people.
Yeah, he's outlasted and outlived just not just the people in the bands who may have passed on, but also just the bands themselves. Even if they've broken up and the people are still surviving, his music has lasted longer than their careers. I mean, I remember when Kurt Cobain passed away, and for like 2 years after that, he would dedicate Smells Like Nirvana to Kurt every single performance.
And, you know, and it's funny, even in their absence, I connect people with Weird Al. I mean, like Prince would be a good example, where he's probably the most famous example of somebody who just would not let Al parody his songs. Again, like I oftentimes I'd be like, well, that's unfortunate, because Al should be allowed to do whatever the hell he wants, but Prince is such a genius and was so weird and had such strong convictions about how his music should be listened to and disseminated, and I kind of appreciate it. Like, you get a lot of leeway for being a genius. I used to say that about Kanye West. You don't have the leeway to support a fucking fascist. Like, I'm sorry, right, I draw the line there. Like, yeah.
You draw the line at fascism. That makes sense.
Exactly. But nice. Why do you think Al has endured the way that he... Because, I mean, that's one of the things that I go to over and over again. Is like, you know, this should have been two silly songs in 1981, not four decades of music that people love.
Yeah, I think he endures because of his, the relatability. Like you said, with the subject matter of the song, sometimes it's just the banality that's so recognizable. But also, I think it's because of the amount of pop culture that Al himself has become. You know, he talks about pop culture a lot and what pop culture means to people throughout the decades in every one of his songs. And yes, while that may date some of the songs, certainly, it doesn't date who or what Al is. And the pop culture of Al himself, of being that cultural icon, of the guy who is always commenting on pop culture and using pop culture to comment on itself, is kind of what has made him surpass all these other acts that he's parodied or aped the style from.
Right, and when it comes to, you know, as someone who is who's sort of a scholar almost of Al's music and the way he sort of repurposes this stuff, and even his style parodies, what do you think it is about the way he repurposes not just songs but genres and styles that that you particularly resonate, that are particularly effective, that make a great song parody? Like, what is sort of the key to that?
Well, that's the biggest draw for me as an Al fan, is the musicality of it. Al and his band are such fantastic musicians that they can play any style, any genre, any motif for a song, and then pairing that with the absurdist lyrics that Al does, either the banality of some inane act like going to a drive-thru, or you know, the synergy buzzwords of corporate America, or, you know, anything like that, or, you know, America's fascination with lawsuits, you know, those kind of all-encompassing things that we all have in common. But pairing it with such expert musicality, not just doing a song that you can do in any genre or any style, but doing it so that it is recognizable as a style of a particular artist. And capturing that idea is very difficult, because there are certain artists who, yes, they have their particular style, but nailing down that style is something that Al really has a great ear for, and is something that I have tried to emulate. I will say, there are certain pastiches that Al does that I'm not 100% on board with. Some of them are supposed to be a pastiche of a certain artist that I don't feel hits all the earmarks. I love Don't Download This Song, but I feel like it misses certain Jim Steinman earmarks that he has in all his musicality. And there's a Hardware Store was originally supposed to be a pastiche of the Presidents of the United States of America.
Oh, interesting.
And what's that?
I said that's interesting. I would not have imagined
It was originally conceived to be a pastiche of that, but then grew out past that so that it doesn't resemble a song by Pusa at all. Skipper Dan is supposed to be a Weezer pastiche, and I feel it doesn't have enough of the earmarks of a Weezer song to qualify as a Weezer pastiche. It stands on its own, and that's the other great thing about these songs, too, is that while they may be pastiches of artist songs or parodies of these artists, every single one of them can stand above being just that. They can be great songs beyond what they're supposed to be emulating.
Yeah, and I feel like with Skipper Dan, I remember when I heard that for the first time, I'm like, oh, this is a really good Fountains of Wayne pastiche.
Yeah, it's a lot more Fountains of Wayne.
And
a lot
of the sonic and the lyrical elements of it, one of which is an element of sadness and melancholy. I feel like that's something that Fountains of Wayne have done really, really well, is these are these, you know, funny songs about people whose lives have failed.
As a failed actor, I absolutely hate Skipper Dan. Hits a little too close to home. It is actually my least favorite Weird Al song.
I think part of it also is that there's a song that, because Airline Amy would be another example of that, where they're kind of, they're not comedy songs necessarily. I mean, they're funny and they're quirky and they definitely have a slant, but I feel like they're definitely like, okay, here's the comedic conceit of the song. It carries through. And then there's songs like, well, this is something that, you know, a non-comedy artist could have recorded.
Absolutely.
For sure.
I think there's definitely albums that go thematically with like Al's attitude about the era at the time too. So
yeah, like, I mean, that's the fascinating thing is like, yeah, you'd look at, you know, four decades of Weird Al and you were looking at four decades of popular culture, and not just popular culture but the culture at large. I mean, you can and I have sort of explored the evolution of technology, of television, of food. You know, he just kind of chronicles the different ways that society just gets stupider and stupider. And more and more.
Well,
more
there's almost a palatable cynicism in not really Mandatory Fun, but the album before Mandatory Fun, which was, oh god, my brain is blanking. I feel terrible.
Apocalypse.
Yeah, there's a certain cynicism in a lot of the songs on Alpocalypse, and you know, this kind of like, I can't even find the words to describe it, but there definitely seems to be a lot more sarcastic edge to a lot of the things that he sings about in both of those, in both Alpocalypse and Mandatory Fun.
Well, there are certain, I mean, and that's one of the interesting things about seeing him perform so many times on the Self-Indulgent Vanity Tour, is he will talk a lot like, oh, this is a song sung from the perspective of blah, 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 that there's the narrative of the song says blah, that it's very overtly like this is, and a lot of times it's because the person singing the song is crazy and maybe violent and kind of, you know, nuts. But it's fascinating to me when there are songs where it feels like some of Al's personality and some of his aggravations, some of his pet peeves kind of come to the circus.
Absolutely.
being insufficiently precise in their language. Certain stuff like, you know, stop forwarding that crap to me, word crimes. I feel like there is definitely an element of Al that he's kind of working through cathartically songs that are more personal than, you know, something like Party in the CIA. I think it's pretty safe to say that he's not, you know, a CIA assassin. He hasn't murdered any people.
But
he gets annoyed at, you know, online culture. He gets annoyed at, you know, people making spelling errors. Like, yeah, that seems very, very close to home.
Oh, definitely. Absolutely. 100% agree.
Nice. Cool. So do we have anything else we want to talk about in terms of Weird Al?
I guess we can just plug the hell out of our respective. Yeah, I would like to encourage everybody, I believe this episode drops the final day of the Weird According to Al book Kickstarter. So please, please, please contribute. Go to Kickstarter and look up the Weird According to Al book. We've done really, really good. Like, suspiciously good. Like, holy shit. Like, 1,000% funded is a possibility. Which is insane. And I think we're going to have a new stretch goal. We had our first stretch goal, which was $13,000? Yeah, $13,000. And I have to watch all of the Weird Al show and write about it. I get to watch all of the Weird Al show and write about it. $15,000, I believe, that's when his season of Comedy Bang Bang, I really, really want to write about. I love the hell out of Comedy Bang Bang and Scott Aukerman. And then, I think $17,000, I'm going to do UHF. Which obviously I've seen, but I don't think I've ever written about extensively. So please, please, please go to my Kickstarter for the Weird According to Al book and go to Insane Ian's Patreon.
Indeed.
Yes. Patreon.com/InsaneIan. But before I get to that, I do want to say thank you to Nathan and Clint, but thank you to Nathan for putting me in the Weird According to Al book in the entry about That Boy Could Dance, because I covered That Boy Could Dance on the most recent Weird Al tribute album, 26 and a half, and you mentioned my cover during your entry on that, so thank you.
And
very
I gotta
much
say, your cover it helped me better appreciate it. I mean, I really, really like the song. It's very funny. It's very clever. There are all sorts of great terms of phrase, and yeah, your cover it really showed that it could work very, very well in like a different context with a different sound. So yeah, you did a very good job, and you definitely will be mentioned in the book itself.
Well done.
I appreciate that. Thank you very much, and thank you both for having me on the show this week.
Oh,
this has been super fun.
Oh, of course. Oh, we ain't done yet.
Oh yes.
So yeah, let's open up the mailbag. Again, if you want to ask us questions, you can do so at asknathanrabinshappycast@gmail.com. It's a bit to type, but you know, it'll be worth it to hear us, you know, say your question on air. So this one comes from Simon McCormick, who says, "Good day to you, gentlemen, from a loyal Patreon across the Atlantic in another politically embarrassing part of the English-speaking world." I tip my cap to you, sir. Do you have a favorite movie set or filmed in a place you lived or grew up in? Is there a film that really captures Madison, Chicago, Atlanta, or in my case, rural Illinois? Or better yet, to your native eyes, a movie that gets these places delightfully wrong? Simon, last name withheld. Well, I already said the whole thing, so sorry, your plan didn't work. But Nathan, what do you say to that?
For some reason, I'm honing in on a movie in Chicago that makes no sense and is terrible, terrible use of it. I'm thinking of Never Been Kissed, which was the Drew Barrymore. I believe the premise of that is that she's like a fact checker at the Chicago Sun-Times. She's like a 26-year-old fact checker at the Sun-Times. And she has her own assistant. And she like pitches a, hey, what if I did an article about going to high school and falling in love? He's like, it's great. Here's $1 million for your story. So I think I am fascinated by that because it gets Chicago exquisitely, wonderfully wrong, and it gets newspapers exquisitely wrong, and it gets the combination of the two incredibly wrong. For some reason, I'm thinking about Atlanta, where I live now. Probably the last movie that I saw that used it really, really well is Baby Driver. I feel like Baby Driver has so many things going for it, one of which is it's a movie that loves the city where it takes place, which is Atlanta. So woohoo, go that. However, I just saw a movie called Gator. Burt Reynolds' directorial debut, 1976. Actually a lot of fun. I really, really enjoyed it. One of the reasons
his favorite movie.
Yeah, I totally believe that. That's really fucking awesome. And one of the reasons why I wanted to see it, because I went on vacation to Savannah, Georgia, and I was at a bar, and they had a big plaque saying, in 1976, part of the Burt Reynolds movie Gator was filmed here. So I was partially watching it, waiting to see that scene. Yep, there it was. It's a brothel. It's an underage brothel. The bar where I had a bunch of drinks is a underage brothel for a drug addicted child prostitute. And I'm like, well, I was there. That's awesome. Woohoo. And then the also is filmed in Tybee Island. So it's funny because it's supposed to take place in like the deep, deep south. And then it was filmed in like two basically tourist traps. But yeah, so those were movies that I really loved that were filmed in places that I've lived. And one that really irritated me.
Nice. Ian, what about you?
Well, I'm originally from, as I said, Baltimore, Maryland. So basically every single John Waters movie 100% accurate.
Nice.
And also I'm an actor, and I've been in, like every single actor in Baltimore, I was on an episode of The Wire. And The Wire is 100% accurate. So it's really weird having this dichotomy of like the bizarre, weird shit that John Waters does and also the seedy, criminalistic underbelly that The Wire exploited. So both of them have been very accurate in their own ways. I can't really think of anything that's kind of like not accurate as far as Baltimore representation. I mean, the weird thing is there's a lot of things that do end up being set in Baltimore. Barry Levinson has a series of films that are set in Baltimore. There was a TV show called Rock.
There's some really good ones. The Tin Men. That's a fucking fantastic movie set in Baltimore.
Avalon was my first work as an actor, that was set in Baltimore, and that was a great movie. I can't really think of anything that doesn't really represent Baltimore well. So I'm kind of at a loss on the bad end, but on the good end, we've got a ton. So
nice. Excellent. Now, like as I said before, I grew up in downstate Illinois, which doesn't get a lot of filmic representation or anything else, really. Like, it's called Forgottonia for a reason, but I do live in Chicago, and of course, there are many, many movies in Chicago, but I think maybe the most realistic portrayal of life in Chicago for me is Transformers Dark of the Moon.
I was going to single that out as I really enjoyed that movie, in spite of it being terrible, because I enjoyed seeing Chicago get destroyed.
Yeah,
part of me wants to see Chicago destroyed by evil robots. I'm just going to admit that.
Yeah, genuinely, anytime I take the Brown Line downtown, I half expect to see just Autobots and Decepticons just trashing the streets. It's funny. I first moved to Chicago around 2010. Myself and my former Alka Hollywood co-host Jared Latour, and he loves telling the story about when he was taking the Red Line or something, or the Green Line downtown. And just walking around absently downtown and suddenly seeing like things on fire and like bits of rubble. And he's like, did something happen? Only realizing far too late that he was on the set of Transformers Dark of the Moon. So I always think of that story when I think of Transformers Dark of the Moon. And just I just think, you know, it just captures that innate Chicago essence that that I think we all understand having been in the Windy City. But I guess in a more serious answer, for some reason, I keep going back to The Big Sick. I think The Big Sick tends to reflect my experience of living in Chicago, like just the feeling of being surrounded by, especially downtown, like all the tall buildings. And then when you go out into the more intimate neighborhoods and just the feeling of like weird wintry camaraderie that kind of happens. It feels like it captures the pace of Chicago living, which can be very malleable at times. So yeah, those two movies I think capture the ebb and flow of Chicago life on screen. All right, well, let's move on. Let's close out with happy places. Nathan, what's your happy place this week?
That is a very good question, one that I have perhaps not thought out in detail too much beforehand. But I was just going to say that my 9-month-old son, Harris, is just a goddamn delight. And it is very, very springtime here in Atlanta. So he has started wearing shorts. And oh my God, there's nothing in the world cuter than a chubby little baby wearing a checkered shorts and a cute little t-shirt. And yeah,
he's like a little ska band.
Yes, he's just, oh my God, he's just a delight. He's just the sweetest, just skinny cutest. It's just weird though to like see him out with other babies because, you know, he's a baby, so his hands will be moving around. I'll be like, don't you be putting hands on a woman, Harris. I know you're 9 months old and you don't really even know that your body exists, but yeah, please. Yeah, Patrice might be a bit more careful right. with your hands waving around everywhere. So yeah, I'd sure. say that is my baby's chubby little thighs and how cute he looks and his little short sets.
Right. Well, and I'm also thinking of the additional benefits of dressing him in ska style and teaching him ska early, because you really need to teach your kids how to pick it up.
They do, exactly.
It's never too early to start skanking.
Exactly.
Ian, what about you?
My happy place, I'm also in the Illinois area, in the greater Chicagoland area, and currently it is snowing.
It's snowing. Right. Oh, God. Insert Game of Thrones joke here.
Oh, Lord.
Yeah, exactly. So this current area is not my happy place. My happy place is I just came back from vacation in Florida, and my happy place was the warmth there, and also being there with my lovely girlfriend. We had an exceptional time there, and right now she is screaming to the heavens, why did we come back? But the happy place is the warmth and the company that we had while we were on vacation.
Well, yeah, I've got a couple happy places. I also just came back from vacation. Mine was for New York, a place I'd never been. So we ended up spending like 5 or 6 days there, catching up with a bunch of friends, old and new. My wife and I just sort of, we stayed at the New Yorker. We just ran around eating a whole bunch of great food. We stayed with my now sister-in-law. For a couple of those days. We also saw Gary, the sequel to Titus Andronicus. We got to see a Broadway play starring Nathan Lane, which was really, really cool. It's like this strange clownish sequel to Titus Andronicus about like this clown turned maid who has to clean the rubble, like the piles of bodies in the wake of Titus Andronicus up, and is a fan of that particular play and Nathan Lane and stuff, and someone who doesn't get to go see like big Broadway theater very often, it was a really cool experience. And yeah, it was nice to get away from it all as somebody who like has 5 or 6 different jobs as a freelancer. It was nice to sort of like put that away. And it was nice to meet our good friend, Nathan's and my good friend, Gina Radcliffe, who is now kind of my second in command over at my brand new outlet, The Spool. It was very much a relief to see her for the first time and to be able to hand the keys over to this thing I've started over to her and have her handle it with aplomb. And God, what else? Oh, I got to meet Dan McCoy again and Stuart Wellington.
Did you go to the Hinterlands?
I went to Hinterlands. Stuart was serving, and Dan stopped by, and Gina stopped by, and also on that Sunday, I got to see Dan be the guest monologuist at UCB for their ASCAT show. And that was a whole lot of fun. That was a really great time. So all in all, it was a great little trip. And now that I'm back, it's nice to be back with my wife and my cat, there's also a documentary film festival happening in my neighborhood. So I've had a bunch of like filmmakers coming in, many I'd interviewed before. And so it's just nice to sort of, you know, it was nice to have the vacation, but it also kind of feels weirdly invigorating to go back to work afterwards.
Yeah, for sure. That sounds delightful. And I'm actually going on vacation to Alabama next week.
Ooh.
You're going to go to the space station something or other with the in-laws. So should be fun.
Nice.
Get in all this hot vacation action.
Yes. Oh, I also got to go to the Museum of the Moving Image and go to see the Jim Henson exhibit, which was really, really cool.
Nice.
But it was real, real fun. Good times all around. So yeah, that pretty much wraps it up for this episode of Nathan Rabin's Happy Cast. Ian, again, thanks so much for coming on. It was a real blast to have you here to talk about semen with us.
Definitely.
Of course, you know, a subject I'm well versed in, clearly.
Right. Sure. Semen and Weird Al. Those are your two modes of expertise.
That's what I have on my business cards. You know.
Yeah. Oh God. Oh. I'm surprised you can actually like separate them.
Anyway, I don't mean physically, but the words.
Oh, okay, gotcha. Just a little flourish. I'm just imagining the scene from American Psycho where everyone's trading their business cards, and you hand it to Patrick Bateman. He's like, "Oh my God, it's embossed with jizz."
That's why it's so white. Yeah,
indeed, that perfect color.
That wraps it up for this episode of Nathan Rabin's Happy Cast. Follow us on Twitter at Rabinscast, me at Clint Worthing, and Nathan at Nathan Rabin. Subscribe to the podcast on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or your favorite podcatcher. Our theme song is by John Began. Check out his stuff at johnbegan.com. Until next time, we wish you a hearty whoop whoop.